First of all, I want to thank Professor Burway for coming to Ohio State, engaging us in these topics, and really using his presidency to elevate these kinds of issues that I think many of us think about and worry about and want to talk about more. So I think it's just wonderful that he's come out here to engage us in these issues. I'm curious about this relationship with Steve, and
you don't want to know.
Steve has obviously chosen, I think, three panelists who are not going to fully agree with his mentor, and he delights in that for some reason. Likes having done that. About a year ago, I got a phone call from a reporter. The reporter said, "I'm from the New York Times. Can you talk to me about race and education?" I said, "You bet I can talk to you about race and education." I was thinking, man, I've been waiting for this phone call my whole life. This is great. Finally, the New York Times is calling me. I have so much to say to them. This is terrific. The only problem was this. I had just come in the door from picking my kids up at school. You know, just came into the kitchen, picked up the phone, and I've got my two kids and, for some reason, two other neighborhood kids, and they're asking for snacks, and somebody's doing homework on fractions with questions, and there's all this chaos going on, and this reporter is telling me, look, I've got a deadline, and I need to talk to you right now about this. So I've got this phone and call, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? This is the New York Times, and fortunately, my wife, Maureen, comes home early from work right then, walks through the door. And I say, "Mo, come here. You've got to take care of all the kids' stuff because I've got a reporter to talk to from the New York Times." And she says, "Yeah, right, the New York Times is calling you."
That helps with your self-worth.
And I say, "Okay, I can talk about race and education." And the reporter says, "I heard that whole thing." "That's really funny." And I said, yeah, it's, my wife is very funny. It's hilarious. Our engagement with the public, I think, often through the media, has its ups and downs like that. But I think most of us would endorse the general notion that we want to be involved in a sociology that is actively engaged with the public. We don't want to be an insular sociology that is focused on issues that no one else cares about. We don't want to be involved in the puzzle solving that is disassociated with real people's lives. We want to be relevant. We want to do things that really matter for the public. And I'm also persuaded at some level that to do this, to have an active public sociology, you need a healthy element of critical sociology. You need people asking, where are we headed? Not just what kind of tools are we using and taking the scientific hammer and just pounding a few nails that look good. Eventually, you do need to stop and think, where are we headed and what are we doing? We don't just mindlessly go about studying whatever is convenient to study that will build a vita and move us along through the professional ranks. And I see some indicators of problems of a lack of this kind of critical sociology at times in our discipline. When I review a manuscript, for example, and I get too many that I believe do not pass the so what question. The question you ask when you're reviewing that, look, suppose everything you say in this article is true. Suppose your representation of past literature is correct, your method, the way that you've executed this is all reasonable. What if we grant all of that? Who cares about what you're saying? Too many of the manuscripts I get, in my opinion, do not pass that so what question. I also see it on the end of being an author and submitting a manuscript to a journal and then getting reviews back at times where I've created this article and I've got this nice big picture forest. I'm dealing with a big, nice question, and these reviews come back nitpicking me on these really mundane little methodological issues. I hear some amens. They'll say, look, we think you should have coded income into 7 categories rather than 11 the way that you did. And I can just sigh and say, you know, we created 17 footnotes for the anal retentive reviewer. You know, maybe we needed 18 in order to deal with this. And this just isn't going to matter. The real value of this manuscript is not down there with how you code that income variable. And I see those kinds of indications, the kind of pathologies that I think Burway's talking about. I would also point out, I think Burway's position is in some ways moderate. He's not asking for us to storm the castle and behead all the positivists in the professional quadrant. He seems to say in his presidential address, look, this professional sociology maintains a level of prominence. He seems to be willing to allow it to maintain that level. He asks for what he calls breathing room for the more reflexive knowledges. And we need to hear more specifically about exactly what he would do to gain that breathing room in order to, I think, really know if we would agree with his specific proposals. But in some ways, I think his proposal is somewhat moderate because he's not asking us to overturn the scientific basis of knowledge. He frequently reminds us that he views professional sociology as the heart of sociology. Nevertheless, overall, I'm unpersuaded by the view that elevating the reflexive part of sociology, that reflexive knowledge, especially the critical sociology, is going to enhance or increase our stature with the public or increase public sociology for 3 reasons. First of all, what I'll call the Nixon-China problem for sociology. You know the phrase, only Nixon could have gone to China. Well, you know, briefly, back in the 70s, we had a very strained relationship with China. And it was politically difficult for any politician at that time to warm relations with China. It would have been viewed as being soft on communism. Ironically, it was Nixon, the guy who had built a career promoting his own anti-communist credentials by purging, you know, the world of communists with Senator Joe McCarthy. It was Nixon who had the political leeway to be the one to moderate our relations with China and visit China in 1972. The irony of this is because of his long anti-communist credentials, he had the most political leverage on influencing issues on the other end of the political spectrum. If he had just gone around making more anti-communist statements, everyone would have said, well, you know, of course Nixon says that. He's always said that. But when he actually warmed relations with China, that is where he had his most leverage. And in sociology, our Nixon-China problem is this. Our reputation is already consistently liberal. And so it puts us in this awkward position publicly. We end up having our most leverage with the public, in my view, when we speak about conservative issues. Even the sociologists are saying X, for example. When James Coleman studied schools and families, and he concluded that, look, inequality in achievement outcomes is primarily a function of families, not schools. Well, conservatives loved hearing that. Liberals did not. And this conclusion had a lot of value in the press and in the academy, in large part because it was coming from a sociologist, a discipline known for its liberal stance. If even a sociologist is saying this, then wow, it really must be true if they're making this conservative statement. My concern with elevating the critical part of sociology, the reflexive part, is that it moves us, it makes our Nixon-China problem even greater. It moves us farther and farther. It moves us away from impartiality to a level at which our real leverage with the public will become even narrower and narrower. And when we really need to say something, when there is really a problem that we need to say something about, our credibility will have been undermined. My second point is that the public that we want to influence, if we want to be a public sociology, the public believes in science. A couple weeks ago at dinner, I asked my kids, Rachel and Nicholas, 9 and 7, if a tree falls in the forest, does it, and no one's there to hear it, does it make a noise? It's fun asking little kids these kind of things. And after a few clarifying questions about tape recorders, and squirrels even, you know, are there squirrels around? After a few clarifying questions, Rachel and Nicholas both said, yes, it makes a noise. And I said, well, how do you know? And Rachel said, because stuff happens even when we're not there. Now, you may not agree with Rachel's philosophy of science, that there is a reality independent of our observations, but the public does. Most people believe in that view of the world. And skepticism of empirical observations is good. Strong skepticism is healthy. But when you get to the point of dismissing evidence, you get to the point of dismissing it out of hand, then something bad happens. The facts don't matter anymore. And this is a problem with our credibility. If we get to that point where the facts don't matter anymore, it's not just that we'll lose credibility with the red states. We lose credibility with the blue states. Blue state people don't believe that facts don't matter. Burway discusses in his presidential address how sociology departments in foreign countries are now starting to move more toward this instrumental professional sociology. They're asking them to publish in our types of journals. Maybe it's because their publics also appreciate science and appreciate what it has to offer. It could be that that's what is attracting them. One benefit of critical sociology that we see in Professor Burway's presidential address is that critical sociology can provide the moral guidance for our discipline. Now, I grew up, my dad's a Protestant minister, so I grew up with a lot of church. And I got a lot of moral guidance from people who strongly believed, had strong beliefs about how the world works, yet they were consistently unwilling to test those beliefs empirically or put them up against alternative explanations. The moral guidance, I think, that we get from that way of thinking of the world, that reflexive knowledge way of here are ideas about how the world works, but we don't have to hold them accountable to data. We don't have to ask whether observations are consistent with these. I am skeptical of the moral guidance that we get from that way of thinking. Third, the consensus in sociology, if we adopted Professor Burway's proposal, would dilute the consensus in sociology. Right now, we are not, if we adopted this proposal, we would not be sending the same message as often to the public. We would be sending a wide range of messages. Prioritizing our message, I think, is part of our job. Figuring out what is good sociology, what are we really saying as a discipline, is part of the job, I think, of doing sociology that will influence the public. We need to make the most of our chances with the public. Finally, in conclusion, Burway believes that a public sociology will benefit from elevating the critical element of the discipline, giving it breathing room. I worry that in his 2x2 table of sociologies, much like what Pam said, that it ends up exaggerating the lack of critical sociology that occurs within the professional quadrant. I also got the impression from his written work that he was saying that most of us end up occupying one quadrant, other than superstars like who have more flexibility, like Christopher Jenks or James Coleman. Most of us are limited to having to live in one quadrant. But when I look around our department here at Ohio State, I don't come to that conclusion that most of us are in one quadrant. My colleagues who I think would lean toward the professional sociology quadrant, but they study things that suggest a real connection to the real world. They study workers' lives, strikes, social movements, family life, gender relations, race, education, obesity among children, spread of sexual diseases, crime, the local Amish life. These agendas are not about esoteric matters of interest to just sociologists. And in my view, I don't think they need moral guidance. Finally, strategically, promoting public sociology by trying to elevate critical sociology impresses me as comparable to trying to defeat George Bush by working for the Ralph Nader campaign.
Doug, you mean you couldn't look for Ralph Nader? First time for it. Exactly.